Amsterdam was an awesome figure. He was already getting to be an awesome figure. And there were people at Temple who loved him and people who feared him and those who hated him. I had a feeling Rosenthal was one of those who feared him and hated him. He certainly didn't like him. Stuart never tried to get into the endodontic department. He did whatever he was doing through Rosenthal, Lenny Rosenthal, in oral medicine. So he never came into the endodontic department in any way. Never gave a lecture, never taught. He and I were like, we had offices next door to each other, but he didn't attempt to get into endodontics. What he did do was to use the research facilities, because the things he was doing could easily be oral medicine as well as anything else. He was like away from pen and not in endodontic, but remember now, he's a periodontist as well at this time. So maybe he didn't miss, you know, not being in the endodontics. But he did research casually. He didn't occupy the place 10% of the time. But as soon as I left, the year later, he filled that vacuum and he was up there in rabbit's eyes. In rabbit's eyes. Always gave me credit, which was nice. He edited a copy of the Dental Clinics of North America many years ago. I did an article in which he used my slides and credited right through the line. He borrowed those rabbit eye slides and used them. But we were developing a good relation, George and I, but he wasn't in the endodontic department ever. Lenny Paris was also in the endodontic department. He had done what I had done previously. Air Force became an endodontist, took the research fellowship with Morty, teaching a little bit. I guess Lenny was aspiring, no, excuse me. Lenny became the head of endodontics. God, I almost forgot that. Lenny, between, when Morty stepped out later, Lenny Paris became the head of endodontics and was a hell of a good teacher, not academic at all, but an enthusiastic, wonderful, driving teacher, enthusiastic, liked people, good endodontist, taught well, and it was when they wanted him to go full-time and he wouldn't do it that Sam stepped into Temple, Sam Seltzer. But Lenny, of course, was on the scene with me, practicing, coming in like a day a week. He was the person I would see more than anybody else. The rest were apparitions. Jimmy Neplasek, a guy would come in half a day. But Lenny was a serious person. He and I would have tremendous discussions. During that year, I'd go to his place. He lived nearby where I lived. We'd set up till 3 o'clock in the morning. He and I, coined the term pre-treatment. And argued, you know, discussed what does it mean? How can we explain it to people? He was an enthusiastic teacher. But I was doing the lecturing. And I was the one who was there all the time. And I was doing the research. But Lenny was like the second person there. And if I stayed, he would have been a competitor, you know, for that job. Anyway, I had no intention of staying. As soon as I left, he filled into the teaching. Morty resigned. George filled into the research space. Lenny didn't want the research space. And George didn't seem to want to get into the endodontic department. Some years later, back at Penn again, you see, back to Penn. Not without a little leaving for UCLA. Okay, so I began the research, I began the teaching, I began to develop my methods of teaching, I began to see what worked, what didn't work. Large class, 128 students or something, big audiences all the time. And then I began to get closer to Lou during this year. The word got out from Morty, hey, this guy is serious. And I was, Raj, 7 days a week on this stuff. Serious. Use that time. I began to go over to Lou and I began to help Lou in his graduate programs. Then we made a deal that Temple and Penn would give some courses together, and especially the surgery program, for the pragmatic reason there weren't enough patients to cut up. So I remember we gave a couple of surgery programs together. And since I was endodontics at Temple, in a way, you see, because Morty wasn't there, I became now acting in a collegial relationship with Lou, even though he knew who he was and I knew who I was. But we'd sit down, what's Temple's position in this? Which was very nice. Threw us together more. He began then, way back then, to this paternalistic attitude towards me that's persisted since. He and I began to get very friendly. We began to recognize certain things in each other back then. And he began to feel more comfortable with me than he did with some of the others there. And I liked it because Morty was good with the checkbook and he was a perfectly nice person and he gave me all this opportunity to do everything I wanted, but he's a Crown and Bridge man. So I can't learn anything from him except to know he's a terrific dentist, that he can fill a root canal if he wants. But I could now have input into Grossman and begin to learn from him, because it was he, LG, who I wanted to know what he was thinking. So I began spending more time with Lou. Not more time than I did at Temple, but more time than the original contract would have called for. I was getting nothing from Penn. So as this year begins to develop, my relationships with Lou on a personal basis began to blossom. Very good year in all these respects. Research, teaching, responsibility, learning endodontics, learning as I did it. Now I'm doing many more molars, getting people out of trouble. One Saturday, Amsterdam calls me. He says, Goldman's in town. Oh, yeah, Goldman's, right. Goldman's in town. I didn't know he's coming here. He's over at Penn. Come on over. I said, I can't. I got the clinic running here. He said, shut the clinic down. He said, finish every case if you have to, which is what I did. You know, got everybody in the stage there, right, finished them off, and ran over to Penn because Goldman's in town. And Henry was going through clinic to clinic. I don't know what the hell he was doing, but people are trailing after him. They're following after him. Funny Boston accents and Goldman, one or two other than. I remember telling Morty after 2 hours of this, I said, he doesn't know who I am. Let me backtrack just for a second. Before I went to Temple, let me backtrack more. I got to meet Irv Abramson while I was in the Army. Irv Abramson had been the national president of my fraternity, Sigma Epsilon Delta, and an established endodontist. I got to meet Irv, I got him to speak down at Aberdeen. He invited me up to the lectures in Maryland, in Baltimore. I went to the office and watched him work. So I got to meet Irv. I remember having a lunch with Irv before I took this contract to Temple. And said, I hear there's a guy named Glasser who's going into Boston. He'll get there first. See, if this seems like we're following several paths at the same time, it's because several things are going on at the same time. So he said, what's his name? I said, Glasser. And he laughed at his lunch. We were eating in a nice restaurant. He's spending maybe $3 for each lunch. I couldn't believe that kind of money. You know, it wasn't Army Chow. This wealthy, you know, impressive person. And he laughs, and I began to feel better. He said, Glasser. He said, the guy they threw out of Philadelphia. I said, I don't know where they threw him out of, but see, I'm not in Philly yet. I'm still at Aberdeen. And he said, but he'll get there first. He said, let him get there first, because there's nobody here except Arthur doing a little nothing. And he convinced me. And then I made some inquiries, and I was satisfied. His success in Boston was phenomenal, because here I was getting feedback not from Boston, and he was to be laughed, ridiculed. So I very wisely accepted that kind of advice. Glasser was at Fort Devens. He was an endodontist because he came from Philadelphia. So if you're from Philadelphia, you're an endodontist. If you're from Ann Arbor, you're an endodontist. And he came into Boston and did it on that. He had never had a second's training in his life. So by this time now, there's an endodontist in Boston and a fraction from Arthur. And people are still talking about Barney Berger's dead. And nobody in Connecticut, nobody between New York and Hudson's Bay. Wow. So, to go back to Henry being there, I said, Morty, he doesn't know who I am. The whole thing is a waste. He doesn't know he's sweating. Whatever the hell Henry was doing there, he must have had finished. Right, he turned on me at maybe 4:30, suddenly, and said, I hear you did everything I told you to do. I haven't seen him or spoken to him since he said, when Grossman says it's all right. He said, I hear you've done everything I told you to do. It was like you hit me, you know, with a ton of feathers. I said, yeah. He said, come in here. And if you know Henry now, he took me to a lecture room. He takes a chalk and he starts drawing a diagram of a building. He says, this is 53 Bay State Road. Here's the first floor layout. Your office will be over here. He's just running on into this. I said, wait a minute. I said, I don't know the place. I said, what if I don't like it? He said, you'll like it. I didn't pursue that any further. You know, I didn't ask another dumb question like that. He said, this is it. And then he was gone, and I said to Morty, do you know what he did? He's like, guess. He said, here's the building, here's all the offices, here's the layout. He showed me the diagram. There's two operatories, there's no equipment. He's going to share a waiting room with a guy named Homer Soles. Who the hell is he? He's a very good dentist in Boston. I said, I haven't seen this man, you know, in a year and a half. But that's what he said. He said, I hear you've done everything I told you to do. So, we set a date when I had to be up there.
Very thorough.
What's that?
He's very thorough, though, isn't he?
Yeah. So, we set a date. I finished my contract on time. I came to Boston, and I can tell you now, to go a little bit ahead in it, Henry had figured out then, the school we're sitting in now, if it's very private, I think he had figured out then, you know the name of the school, Raj? You know where you're sitting?
Goldman School.
The Henry M. Goldman School. I think he had that figured out then. You know, there was nothing here but tenements, and BU didn't know that, BU didn't know what he had in mind. But I've got a feeling that he knew what he had in mind. Mm-hmm. Way back then, he was putting his pieces together, little by little. Spencer didn't exist. He was looking for a Spencer. Kramer existed. He was figuring a way to get him into this troika, you know, to get his horses together. But he was figuring the whole thing out then, I'm sure. When I arrived in Boston, they had the office, they had patients. He told me where I was lecturing one day, that I was giving a course. Got to backtrack if you really want the details on this. I remember being invited up to Boston to give a table clinic at the Greater Boston Dental Society. Leo Talcott picked me up at the airport and took me back to the airport. Mm-hmm. And a one-day course at the Beth Israel Hospital that I couldn't understand what Dave Barabin and Leo Talcott and Frank Burson and a lot of other people were taking the course for. About 30 people took that course in Henry's continuing education program that I gave. And I remember flying back that night in a storm on an old DC-3 with fire coming out of the motors, which was normal then. But I remember because I called the stewardess. I said, I hate to tell you this.
But the engine's
on fire. She said, I hate to tell you this, but that's the way these engines are. that's normal. But I did that. A table clinic of an afternoon where Arthur Pearson was the speaker for the evening and a lecture at the Beth Israel. So we did have that contact. But I'm sure it wasn't through Henry. It must have been through some agent of Henry. I came up here. The day I unpacked my stuff, it was a hot day, 93 degrees, can't forget it, hot as hell. Henry called me at home and said, Judge Kirk's niece or granddaughter broke her tooth. I said, it involved a pulp. He said, no. I said, then there's no problem. Why don't you tell her? He said, what'd you say? I said, why don't you tell her? He said, I didn't bring you here from Philadelphia, so I would tell her. He said, until today, I would have to tell her. Are you an endodontist? He said, I thought I brought an endodontist. I said, yes. He says, then you will tell her. I said, I haven't got an office. He said, you come to my office. I'll have her there next day. And I told her. And this is personal now, Raj, but if you really want to know this, when I got done, that he said, well, you going to have your letterhead put together soon? Pretty. I said, I guess so. He said, you'll send her a bill. And I said, but I didn't do anything. He said, yes, you did. She had the broken tooth. She didn't know what it meant. You were the expert. You did plenty. He said, you send her a bill on your lead head when you get it. And you're here. You're established.
Cool.
I said, what's my... He says, your services. None of my lead head. Yours when you get your stuff.
Henry, very important to instill that pride.
Right. Incredible. He says, you're... But he said, yesterday I would have been the expert. Now I know as much as I did before, but you know, you're the expert. At lunch he took me over to see Homer Soles, showed me the office. I figured, this has got to be the pits. You know, what are my friends in New York and Philadelphia going to say about this home? That's a dental office. It seemed weird. Bay State Road in those days was the greatest thing in the world. People practiced in the library of the old mansions with the books on the place. Homer's practice, it was the first floor of 53 Bay State Road. Homer would open in the winter the windows on the river and put a fur lap rug on the patients and have a fire in the fireplace. And he had the greeting room, Ellis Dunham had practiced in the pantry, big enough for a suite of offices. Leonard Nathan, who died last week, was above me. He was in the ballroom, the dancing area. He was in the ballroom in this mansion, and I had the library.
Perfect.
I said, this can't be. Can't practice here. This is kooky. So I figured, get out of it easy. Ask for the rent. I can't pay it, and that's it. So I asked Tommy Sells, what's the rent? And he said, young man, he said, I take 12 weeks vacation every summer. He said, I leave tomorrow for my vacation. He said, I can't discuss money with you. He said, there's the office. So I said, well, I can't accept it that way. He said, well, let's say you'll pay me rent when I come back. And meanwhile, you use it. I said, I can't do that either. He said, well, we're not getting along. He said, this office has been empty for 2 years now, not because I can't rent it, but we don't let just anybody rent in this building. Mm-hmm. He said, Henry Goldman said it's all right. Talcott had been in there previously. He had moved out. He said, he didn't say, but he implied, I was the only non-Harvard person in the building. Multiples of years younger than anybody else. Mm-hmm. It was like the U.S. Senate. Paul Boyle, who used to be dean at Penn, he used to practice there years ago. Kurt Tomey used to practice in the building. He said, I can't discuss it with you. He said, if you feel that way about it, he said, we'll settle the rent. He said, Miss Derby, he said, look up the rent, and Dr. Schilder is paying half of the previous rent, starting in September 15th. He said, now I have to go, but he can be here now. I said, that's not fair to you. He said, you worry about being fair to me? He said, good. He said, you stay at the full rent. Here's the verbal contract now. Here's my rent contract. He said, you stay at the full rent for as long as you stay at the half rent. Well, I guess that's what it was. I said, how long will I be at the half rent? He's leaving. He said, you be at the half rent as long as you like. I said, I don't understand that. He says, you just stay with me at the full rent of what the last Talcott paid for the period you're at the half rent. And now it's getting to be June, I gotta go away, and you can start paying in September. That was my rent deal. Mm-hmm. I go, Missy, you better hurry up because we got patients lined up for you. I went into the office, and there was an old Weber unit dismantled like a skeleton on the floor of one operatory. I said, who owns this? A fellow named Julius Levine. His brother was Levine, the cardiologist, who was the cardiologist with Paul Dudley White for Eisenhower, professor of cardiology at Harvard, just recently died, distinguished cardiologist. Went up to see Julius. He practiced on the third floor. He said, oh, that unit? He said, I thought I'd use it, but I don't use it. It's old anyway. He said, it's sitting there. He said, you want it? I said, wait a minute. I just had a traumatic morning. I said, what if you don't want it? He said, well, I'm not giving it away, you know. I said, what do you want? He said, I'll take $600 for the unit and the chair and all the stuff down there. I said, how do you want it? He said, $50 a month. That was my unit.
You really had the opportunity knocking.
Yeah. In the other operatory was a chair. Boy, if you want history, I wonder what happened to that chair. They called it a Harvard chair. It was like straw back, some weird stuff. So I got a screen to block that out. Left the plumbing, left the chair. Got a screen to block it out. Didn't take it out, used it eventually. And I had this one chair operatory. Bought a second-hand x-ray machine from a young dental dealer. This kid, what the hell was his name? Psyker, I think his name was. He was going around peddling burrs, opening up packages of burrs, selling you one steel burr out of a package of six on credit if you wanted it. For a few hundred bucks, I got a used x-ray machine. The whole thing didn't cost $2,000. Bought a desk. That probably cost me more than the dental equipment. And I was in practice. Now, the point here is, I began seeing patients in Leo Talcow's office. Again, not billed to him, billed to me, because they couldn't wait. They had patients ready for me. Leo was up the street. As soon as my office was open, the crux of this is, Henry had patients waiting. He had teaching positions waiting at the Beth Israel. He told me what my September schedule was, my October schedule, where I'd be teaching. And that's how I moved into this town. Just instantaneously getting into that kind of stuff.
Amazing.
And that's all just a little piece of my story.
Okay.
But that's you. This is only an answer to your question.
How'd you end up in Boston?
How did I end up? No, what my educational background was
educational
in Edinburgh.
And how you came.
Let me tell you a little bit more in sidelight. Okay. Two things about two personalities we mentioned. When I was in Philadelphia, I had been doing the work with the Crescent. It wasn't with Crescent, it was inflammatory potential of root canal drugs, and the Crescent just turned out to have the results that it did. We weren't expecting it. Being aggressive and having nice people, I arranged to give a table clinic at the meeting of the American Association of Endodontics. Lou helped me to do that, and then I needed a view box, and Lou lent me his view box, which I remember carrying out on an airplane under my seat on a super constellation in those days. But we were getting pretty close, because Lou lent me his view box to take out. In the early days, we may be getting into a different question. I remember reading the paper on the inflammatory potential. I might have been in Boston by then. Would have to be, because that would be another year. I remember Stewart introducing me, and he gave me an incredible introduction. Bright, this coming up and coming person, important in endodontics, the rest of it. But the reason I'm telling you is something else. My heart was palpitating. It's a joke, you know, when I think of it today. I was palpitating, my heart was up in my throat. What I kept saying was, stop, let me get up there. You know, if you get started, it overcomes that. But when I think of the years that have gone by, he gave me the most glowing introduction that anybody could give some, because I was a kid. I was very young. Whatever I did, I was very young. I kidded you before about taking the girls out, you know. And when I was teaching, I was a kid. I was dating girls about 3 years older than myself. But here, I was just a kid in this environment. It's very important for your history of endodontics. A lot of people went, who the hell is this kid? And Stewart gave this big introduction, and then I did a hell of a good job with that paper. And in those days, only one thing happened at a time at the meeting, and everybody was at every lecture. And I think I established myself right then and there with the way I handled myself at that time. But it's an interesting byplay to think back the way Stewart, how nervous I was with this kind of phenomenon. Now at that time, our back took off at me with a question period right then. I had known him in New York, but he was known as a caustic. Oh, was my caustic. Again, Mike has recommended me as man of the year for NYU for next year from the dental school. Again, I established a marvelous relationship with a guy who's a terror. Mike Auerbach is cruel.
Unbelievable.
Vicious. I've been in a taxi cab with him in Chicago once when he turned around to a well-known endodontist from New York whose name I will leave out because this is too mean. He was in the front next to the driver. I was in the back next to the guy and another person. And he said, Herb, who in New York would ever believe, would anybody believe, or in Chicago, New York, that I'd be in a taxi cab with that, with him? I mean, cruel things. And I remember he said, tell me, how will your endodontic practice be altered by, will it be your rabbits or your human patients will be altered by this kind of stuff? Anyway, I found ways to answer him. If you want the history of this stuff, because I think it's important, I answered him. Had no relationship with him previously. And then a year or two later, well, you might as well know this, by one of the people you interviewed in your goddamn thing, the AAE has been trying, and this is no shit, this is not paranoia, to do a job on me for some time. I've accepted the challenge, and they can do their shtick, and I do mine. But Jake, some complicated political thing some time ago, I used to be on the program every year. Every year I spoke. And Raj, truthfully, every year when I spoke, whether they were smoking or whatever they were doing, they came into that room to hear what I had to say this year. Within a year or two, being very young and being in this kind of thing, I can remember some of the old-timers, a fellow named Epstein out in Minneapolis. Distinguished old gentleman wouldn't know, who the hell is this kid? I remember having a discussion, and he said, you kids with all this new stuff. He said, you, he said, how can you know endodontics? He said, you know, we've been doing this for 30, general practitioner. We've been doing this for 30 years, and a nice guy. I ended up with a marvelous relationship with him. But he says, you have no experience and this and the other. And within a short time, I remember Mike coming up, the guy who had been jumping on me a year or two earlier. He put his hand on my shoulder and put the hand on Epstein and says, hey, Epstein, Irwin. He said, knock it off. This guy's all right. This guy, yeah. That's a good speech for somebody else, Irwin. But this guy's okay. You know. Lay it off. You'd be surprised. This guy knows what's going on. So little by little, this kind of thing was developed. I threw that into you because I want you to get the feeling. They didn't know what to do with a young person who maybe had more biology background than them. Don't forget, it was biology I was teaching. Mm-hmm. It was the enzyme chemistry and the ecology that I was studying. I've said many times that the endodontic biology I learned in my freshman year in college. Only I didn't know it was going to be endodontics. It's just common sense biologic principles. And this was all happening at that time.
Would you comment on, you know, historically what your relationship has been with the AAE and where if you place?
Can we do that another time, or because this gets sensitive? Sure, I'll be glad to answer. What do you want? Let's hear it.
Where, you know, historically what your relationship has been and how you view the importance of the AAE as being like a representative of endodontic interests.
Specific question.
Specifically.
Okay, we've got my educational background, how I got into this kind of stuff.
Okay. Because we're all concerned about where endodontics is going. And we all are concerned with having good spokesmen out there. And we're all concerned with the fact that the AAE has been controlled, you know, so strongly.
Who's all? Who's concerned about this? A lot of people are, but are you?
A lot of people are, sure.
You mentioned Bert Wolfson. I remember having dinner up on the North Shore with Bert Wolfson, North Shore of Massachusetts, when he must have spoken here, cussing like hell about somebody you previously interviewed. And I remember going home and telling Joan, can you believe Wolfson in San Francisco is perceptive enough to catch what the hell Jake Friedland is doing? Mm-hmm. But, Roger, if I say anything now, if anything, I'm a realist. Jake has had an incredible influence on the AAE in the last 10 or 15 years. So anything I say shouldn't be interpreted as sour grapes, blah, 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 exactly. Because I'm not saying this guy could, this guy has. Do you see? It's nice to admit what somebody else can do. The AAE changed dramatically, I think, with Jake. I think Jake's very important in the history of the AAE during an interval. His time is over. Jake's time is over. But what about the AAE? Let me give you my perception of the AAE. From speaking to the older people, you can get some insight into the AAE when there are only 25 or 30 of them. Mm-hmm. Miles has got that in his history. Did you spoke to Vince?
Sure.
You got the picture then.
Got the old picture.
When I got into the AAE in 54 or 55, they had about 300 members, as far as I could judge.
Still the club atmosphere there.
Right. I can remember flying out on a plane with George when George was Secretary of Treasury from the Philadelphia days. Or I met him on a plane from New York when I was already in Boston, and he said they're getting more members. And I remember saying then, is bigger better? Mm-hmm. I didn't mean in terms of exclusivity, but it was getting a little unwieldy. Now, when I got into it, they met in Chicago. They met in the second or third floor conference rooms at the Hilton Hotel with the Chicago Midwinter meeting. 2 days before. Everybody took everything. And if you made a pronouncement in endodontics, whether they agreed or not, everybody heard it. Nobody wondered what the hell was going on. The big political issue then was the boards. And you talk about directions. We, I, and Bert, different age. 35 years older than me. We were beginning to feel the difference between the endodontists and the non-endodontists because of the boards. The AAE was sending to the ADA a triumvirate of non-endodontists. They were sending Ralph and Lou and Harry Healy, basically. And I kept saying then, the political animal in me was saying then, they go to the Board of Trustees, they're all well known. I would think that after they turned their tape off, they'd say, hey Harry, make any nice bridges lately? What the hell are you guys asking for a specialty for? You kidding? None of you specialize. Mm-hmm. And I felt at that time they got to find guys like me or the Abramsons and the Wolfsons. And hey, when I say guys like me, I meant guys like me and them, these old grandfathers. Right. These guys are going to be great grandfathers. We were the endodontists. And we felt that the putting off of the acceptance of the boards, you know, endodontics is the last specialty accepted, had a hell of a time getting through the House of Delegates, year after year being rejected. And we felt the wrong people were going. Not that they weren't great people, but they weren't endodontists. It's a very sensitive issue. They weren't endodontists.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was certainly a question of legitimacy there.
Right. Now, in terms of the group was effective, finally. The big thing at all the endodontic meetings was not N2. They waited for Somers' report on what's the status with the boards. What's the status with the boards? And then all listened hushed for that. Now, the AE was having tremendously beneficial effect. I say I was on the program every year, not soliciting it. They wanted to know what this, I'm fermenting things, and I'm thinking of things and coming up with ideas, challenging their access cavities, challenging their drugs, challenging their fillings, challenging their silver cones, talking accessory canals.
Right. Brought a whole level of evolution to all of endodontics.
Yeah. If we're putting this stuff on the tape and we're doing this on such an open basis, I was a little concerned that people hadn't spoken to me because I really see myself as the turning point, like that Italian journal said. The turning point in this is saying, hey, enough of the crap, let's begin to think of this thing clearly. Now, I obviously had to have all the other background and learn from all these other people so I could begin to, you know, analyze it and know what I wanted to do. I learned from these people. But I began to see some of the inconsistencies in what they were doing and had the balls, if you will, to pronounce your access cavities are too damn small. Sam and IB, you make too many people uncomfortable. Lou, you treat too many people in an hour. You know? Mm-hmm. And the other guys, you're not filling your canals. And it can be a hell of a lot better. The stuff I was doing that, you know, you people, the students, take as common sense, every one of those things was a battle. Every one of those, what the hell does he want from us? You know, what the hell is... Every one of those things, which I'm happy to say, are getting to be the norm now. It's when you don't do it that it's outside the norm. Every one of those things, the insistence on cleaning and shaping, the three-dimensional filling, when a lot of people we know quite close by, you know, are talking about different things. Somebody's trying to put their signature, you know, make a little alteration, which is fine, which is normal development. But the whole idea on three-dimensionality, the whole idea on the cleaning and shaping, the whole idea on the surgical different approaches, the business on the access cavities, the drugs, the rash, they're working a little slower. Even the charging a little more, which I think I got from that guy I never met, Barney Berg, you know, to do it a little better. Maybe that's why Barney did better stuff in those days, because he didn't have to see so many patients. You know, he did it a little better. So I really feel that was a pivotal time in here. Now, I began to get into that thing, and everything was going fine in a sense. The group was controlled politically from Chicago and Detroit. Miles may not have known it, but Miles has mellowed so in the last 20 years. There's another one who puts his arm over me and my boy, he says, boy, I didn't think he thought of my boy at the beginning. He controlled that group, and people resented it.